is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we learn all about the medical value of marijuana. Plus, we explore how to get through the holidays if you're grieving. But first, some great news for Central New York families and those children who need kidney dialysis. Well, it's long been a maxim in pediatrics that children are not simply small adults. And those children who require dialysis need specialized care developed just for them. Dr. Scott Sherman, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Director of Nephrology at Upstate Medical University, knows this better than anyone, and he's here with us with some great news for Central New York families. Welcome, Dr. Sherman.
Welcome. Thank you.
So you've got some great news for us. What is it?
Well, our children who require dialysis will soon be moving into a new center within University Hospital, specifically designed for them, their needs, and the needs of their families.
Well, that is really great. Where have they been to date?
For the last 30 or more years here in Syracuse, children who've needed dialysis have received it at a center approximately a mile from the hospital, the same center that does dialysis in adult patients. And as you can imagine, the needs, not just medical needs, but also really the psychosocial
and
needs
emotional
needs of the children and their families definitely different between children and adults.
Help us understand when we talk about children who need dialysis, mm-hmm. who are these children? What type of disease entities do they suffer from? Tell us more about that.
Children who suffer renal failure that ultimately requires they need dialysis come under one of two broad categories. The majority, about two-thirds of them, are born with abnormal kidneys. So their kidneys during development did not form properly. That can be in conjunction with problems related to their bladder or their urinary tract.
Is that often genetically determined, or is it just happenstance?
Yes, it's rarely a genetic disorder. Occasionally, but rarely. Usually it is a random event.
Doesn't necessarily run in families.
Correct. Like any family with a newborn baby, they have expectations for their baby, and those change when they find out that their baby has a significant problem with their kidneys, one that at that time or ultimately may require a pretty dramatic intervention, which is what dialysis in a small child is.
And eventually, does that always mean that they will need a kidney transplant mm-hmm. at some point?
The dialysis for children is always a bridge to transplantation. So we use dialysis to keep them healthy until they ultimately can receive a kidney transplant.
And so you were starting to say that there was another set of children that would also come under
yes.
this umbrella.
So the other roughly third are children that are born with normal kidneys but develop some type of disease that in essence attacks and eventually destroys their kidneys and their kidney function.
And does that happen as a result of a virus? I mean, what kinds of diseases?
Most of those could be lumped under the umbrella of kind of autoimmune diseases. People are familiar with lupus. And some of our patients who require dialysis have lupus that has attacked their kidneys. Some have other diseases in which the body, in essence, attacks the kidneys and eventually destroys the filters of the kidneys.
So how frequently does a child, if for whatever reason they have a malfunction in their kidneys, how frequently do they require dialysis?
There are two types of dialysis. The one most people are vaguely familiar with is hemodialysis, in which the blood is withdrawn from the body and put through an artificial filter, and then the clean blood is returned to the patient. And that is done 3 times a week in a dialysis center, usually for 4 or so hours per treatment.
Wow.
For our patients, that is a particular burden because most of them come from a significant distance. So of all the patients we have currently on hemodialysis, they are traveling between 1 and 2 hours each way to receive their dialysis.
So how will the new center be different?
The new center will provide the same nuts and bolts treatments that they've been receiving, but in a setting that is completely different. Currently, our patients are treated next to adult patients. These are nice people. Everybody who works with them are nice people, but it's a scary setting. It's a large room with people that are getting sick, and it's not a warm and inviting environment. Our new center will have bays that are specifically designed for children to distract them from the treatment itself in many cases, that will be able to accommodate a family member that can help support them and help support us support the child during the treatment. The treatments themselves sometimes cause discomfort. They certainly can cause significant anxiety. And so the setting itself, plus the addition of professionals like child life specialists and their immediate availability, will be a huge upgrade for our families.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Scott Sherman, Upstate pediatric nephrologist, and we're talking about the new pediatric dialysis center at Upstate. So what other benefits or factors will happen by relocating? In other words, will they be closer to their physicians in terms of people checking in on them, that kind of thing?
Yeah, not just their physicians, but their nurse who serves really as a case manager. The nurses and the other support staff in dialysis almost become an extension of the families. I mean, the intensity of the therapy almost mandates that.
And the fact that they're doing it as frequently as they are. I mean, if it's truly that frequent, you really do become kind of an environment unto yourself. I mean,
correct.
A world unto yourself.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, it's almost their own community.
Yeah.
And so having them here will allow immediate access if they have a medical problem. Currently, if a patient has a medical problem during the procedure, I or one of my colleagues is not immediately available, but we will be now. But not just physician oversight, but our nurse manager. There's always nurses available to take care of the patients now, but the nurse manager and the social worker, the dietitian, that are all part of the team for these patients, will be immediately available.
So they'll
all
be co-located.
Correct.
In the same environment. So it really does become almost a community.
Mm-hmm.
and a multidisciplinary team.
Yes, it's a team that really helps facilitate the care of the patient.
And how will some of this relocation and new services offered help in terms of parent interaction? I mean, will there be a training component? What other things will you be offering?
Yes. So the second type of dialysis, what we call peritoneal dialysis, involves significant training. It's ideal for patients, particularly that to maximize their ability to go to school, because it's done at home. Some of our patients cannot have that, and they're done.
They need to come to the center.
But that involves training, which will occur in our center with our nurses. trained in taking care of not just dialysis patients, but children as well.
So the parents are trained to do the dialysis at home.
Correct.
And therefore they don't have to travel this long distance, and the kids can go to school and have an otherwise somewhat relatively normal schedule.
Correct. Yeah, they come to see us generally after they've become comfortable with the treatments and proficient with the treatments. They come and see us once a month. So that we can provide necessary adjustments and oversight for their therapy.
So where are you going to actually be located?
So the hemodialysis will be done on the fifth floor of University Hospital.
Is that part of the Golisano Center, or is it separate?
It's a separate. Mm-hmm. And it's down the hall.
Mm-hmm. So near.
Yeah, oh yeah. So the patients will have their own separate pediatric waiting area and then their own separate really environment. They call them bays for the dialysis. The peritoneal dialysis training will occur in our offices, which are across the street from the children's hospital.
So they do, in that sense, everything will be a lot better coordinated with your...
Oh, yeah.
Under your oversight, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, we have oversight now, but this will really raise it to a different level, really get it to the level that is become the standard of care for pediatrics throughout North America.
How, on average, how long are kids, you know, required or you know, what's the average length of time they need to be undergoing dialysis before they might...
get a transplant.
Yes, especially if they're born with a problem.
Mm-hmm. So once they're on dialysis, the average time before a transplant is roughly a year. Generally, we stabilize the patient's medical condition, and then we aggressively try and search for a donor for transplantation. And that time frame usually ends up being around a year.
Do the donor's kidneys have to be a child's kidneys?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
They are almost always adults, the donors. If you put a kidney from a child into a child, the blood vessels in each are very small, and it increases the risk of complications, including clotting and rejection. So if a family member is available, an adult family member.
A good match.
Yes, that helps facilitate the process. If such a person is not available, then the patients are placed on what's called the deceased donor transplant list. And there are certain advantages to children to try and shorten their waiting time to get a transplant.
In other words,
they're a little bit ahead of the line.
Mm-hmm.
Not at the absolute top, front of the line, but they get a little bit of a head start.
So are you generally finding that a year is a reasonable waiting time? In terms of the expectation of these parents, that it's usually within a year?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And then once that happens, they're free of dialysis at that point?
Correct. So the technology of transplantation has improved dramatically over the last 10, 20 years. And so these patients are free of dialysis. They have to take medications, but they're free of dialysis.
Well, it sounds, just very briefly, when will the new center open?
We're looking at roughly April or May of next year.
Sounds
the construction
great.
Has already started.
Sounds great. Well, my guest has been Dr. Scott Sherman, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and the Director of Nephrology at Upstate Medical University. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing this with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Coming up, the medical uses of marijuana and the myths surrounding it. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. The year was 1970, and the Assistant Secretary of Health, Dr. Roger Egberg, wrote a letter recommending that the plant marijuana be classified as a Schedule I substance, and it has remained that way for nearly 45 years. But recent research and new legislation has changed its status and what we know about its medicinal potential. We'll hear with more on this is Dr. Gene Tinelli, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Tinelli.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the Schedule I drug concept.
The DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, which is composed mainly of criminal justice personnel, regulates substances by category. Category 1, Schedule 1, are substances that have no medicinal value and have a high potential for abuse. Which is rather strange because all physicians get controlled prescription privileges through the DEA. And as I say, they're criminal justice. So in this country, we have the psychotic situation of cops telling docs what is and what is not proper medicine.
So you're basically an advocate here for exploring and understanding the very strong and positive evidence for the medicinal value
very much
of marijuana.
So. And so my conclusion is straightforward. To legalize all drugs in the sense of breaking the prohibition, move everything to Schedule 2 that's in Schedule 1, so at least to be available for research.
What is Schedule 2?
Schedule 2 is some medicinal purposes, but possibly a high potential for abuse. Things like oxycodone is in there, some of the opiates and so forth, which is adequate, but move them all out of there so we can at least do research on these things. And the DEA is basically cops telling docs what is and what is not proper medicine. That's just ridiculous.
Well, we've been alluding to the medicinal value of mm-hmm. marijuana. Let's start talking about what really those properties are. What can marijuana do to aid us, help us?
Well, the first thing that people noticed with marijuana, and not recently, it's been noted for many years, is that there is a psychoactive effect. There's a calming, euphoric effect. People tend to make connections that they didn't make before. If they make too many, it can look like paranoia, which is interesting enough, because one of the compounds, THC, can do that, though that's rare. And it also causes forgetfulness, which is thought of as kind of humorous. People forget what they're saying in the middle of the sentence. But it turns out the system that marijuana affects, the endocannabinoid system in the body, is the second oldest neurotransmitter system. And it works as a neuroprotective system. And it works with a balance of THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, which was the main psychoactive component of the 60 or so active compounds in the hemp plant, and something called cannabidiol, which is, they balance each other. Now, THC, which got a lot of things for the alleged stoner high, that calming euphoric effect and so forth, was very highly praised, and marijuana has now been bred, so most of the species are high in THC.
To what effect, though? Obviously the calming effect, but from a medicinal standpoint, how would they help us?
From a medicinal standpoint, THC tends to be antispasmodic. It'll release muscle spasms, for example, in people with multiple sclerosis who have spasticity. Instead of being in a wheelchair for about 4 hours, they can use a walker. And Marinol, which is synthetic THC, just THC without any balancing agents, can do similar things for a longer period of time, but most people don't like it because they don't like the effects, even if they've used marijuana before. They don't like the side effects because there's nothing to balance it, which is the cannabidiol and some of the other things.
So you're saying true marijuana is really the better drug rather than just...
by far.
...than extracting the THC alone.
Extracting all the active components works very well. You can do it a number of ways, too, for marijuana. You can make an alcohol elixir, which is actually sold by GW Pharmaceuticals in the United Kingdom, and I think that's only used in the United Kingdom. Canada has its own form, and it can be sublingual.
So the point I'm just trying to get to here, is that it has many potentially medicinal effects.
Yes, like without inhaling a burning plant, too. You can use a vaporizer, for example. So inhaling a burning plant is not healthy, period. But there's a number of healthy things that marijuana does. THC itself tends to have an effect on retarding nausea and vomiting for chemotherapy to a lesser extent, radiation therapy. But that's a big thing because if people can eat, they can survive.
Can it help with seizure activity? I read somewhere that it can help
mediate
seizures.
That's probably cannabidiol. But remember, every time I say cannabidiol or THC, it's a balance between the two. And when
if you're using the marijuana in whatever other form rather than inhaling it, mm-hmm. you would be getting those positive effects.
Yes. And what you get depends on the ratio of THC to cannabidiol. If the cannabidiol is about 1% or more, it will tend to displace THC from the receptors on the endocannabinoid system. So it kind of balances. It also, I'll say the word potentiated, but it makes more powerful and makes something called anandamide last longer, which is what the body makes that THC and cannabidiol mimic. So
overall, what I'm hearing, because some of this stuff is a little technical, I think, even for our listeners, mm-hmm. is that marijuana really has some very valid and important contributions to be made as a medicine.
Yes, it does. And people say, well, it's not a medicine if Big Pharma doesn't make it and put it in a pill or something like that. But these are herbal treatments, and herbal treatments are quite common, like in traditional Chinese medicine and a lot of other forms of healing. And as I say, you don't have to burn it to get the...
I think that's crucial here, too, because we do know that inhaling that without any kind of filter system can potentially be damaging to one's lungs.
And what people with medical marijuana that have never smoked a cigarette, for example, and don't want to smoke a joint, what they do is they get a vaporizer, which just basically you put some dried marijuana in a little glass with a tube on it, and you draw air that's about 325 or 350 degrees over the dried marijuana, which takes off all the volatile compounds that you want. And cellulose burns at Fahrenheit 451, so it never forms particulates. So it's very safe.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here along with Dr. Jean Tinelli, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. And we're talking about marijuana, its medicinal uses. And where I want to go to now is, really, are there any dangers, though? We talk about this now that it mm-hmm. has some really powerful medicinal effects that have been ignored or been vilified by making it a level one or a schedule one mm-hmm. substance. What about this notion of addiction?
Well, first of all, one more thing about cannabidiol. It seems to be neuroprotective, and it seems to stop some neurological cancers in their tracks.
Really?
Yes. It seems to be an anti-cancer drug, in addition to being an antipsychotic drug also. And also treats, to some extent, mania and depression.
So when you say anti-cancer or antipsychotic, are they used to treat those conditions? Or
they will be.
Or would they? Okay, so my question here is, are you suggesting that if you were perhaps a regular marijuana user, mm-hmm. that you might be less apt to contract cancer? Or are you saying...
And probably, but those studies are going to have to be done. That's going to be tough. But in lab studies and petri dishes and so forth, when you put certain cancer cells like glioblastoma, which is a neurological cancer, in, and you add an extract of marijuana, cannabidiol and the THC plus the other, its other little friends, the cancer stops growing.
So it actually can retard the development.
It stops
of
growing.
The cancer.
Yeah, retard the development. Yeah, and that's going to take a lot of research to get out. But there's other things that. That it can do, but basically it's neuroprotective, which is interesting. And that cannabinoid system in our body, which is a very old one, is something that balances our body, is a good way to put it. It tends to restore homeostasis, that balance that we all have. So rather than just think of it as THC and the calming or the euphoric effect and psychoactive effect of THC, if you think of the whole plant and the mixtures, it tends to be a balancing agent for a neurological system that we've adapted to for probably hundreds of thousands of years.
But so are you advocating regular daily use, much like you might take a vitamin pill?
It depends on, and that we have to work out. It kind of depends on what you're treating and how you're treating it. Like people who have chronic pain who are on opiates. For breakthrough pain, they're told to take more opiates. A lot of times they don't like to do that.
Addictive as well.
They can be. And they can use a little marijuana, which adds to the suffering-relieving component. One of the things that marijuana does is it decreases your memory of suffering. If you've ever had severe pain in your life, and I said, well, can you experience that pain now? You'd say no. But that's what marijuana does. It helps us forget suffering, because forgetting is every bit as important as remembering. Otherwise, suffering would overwhelm our capacity, and people would have defective anandamide systems. The endocannabinoid part of it, are more subject to post-traumatic stress disorder.
So you think that it would help that as well?
Oh, yes. And a lot of vets use it that way, too.
So, but how about the notion that it can be dependent, people can develop a dependency?
Well, you have to say...
And let me just ask you this, and that, for example, I've read something that there can be withdrawal symptoms, including insomnia, anxiety, or even nausea, if you're a regular user. What do you say to that?
Yeah, the things that substances do, if you want to look at withdrawal, look at the opposite. And you tend to find most of them. That's true with marijuana. About 15% of regular, moderate, or greater users will experience some sort of withdrawal. The anxiety they describe is mild, sometimes a little sleeplessness for a day or two. It's not long. The withdrawal is mild and minor compared to most other substances where we think of have a big withdrawal potential.
Like psychotropic drugs of other kinds.
Yeah, very much so. And it takes the cells a while to reset. And some people say two, 3 weeks off regular marijuana, they say, well, it's almost like a veil is lifted. I can think a little clearer. Which, okay, you're thinking differently.
But let me get to this point. We're also talking about the abuse of marijuana, especially in the youth. And it's been said that a young brain is much more potentially damaged by something like regular use of marijuana.
Regular use of almost anything affects a young developing brain, be it marijuana or be it playing football and getting concussions. The brain is developing. And the male brain doesn't develop till 28. So I'll give you an idea. Most women know that. But
So you wouldn't, but the point here, I'm trying to get
Could it affect the brain? Yes, it could. Could it affect IQ? You can't demonstrate that in people with average IQ or above. In people with lower IQ that regularly use, you can see a decrease in IQ testing. That doesn't necessarily mean intelligence, because you can make better connections. But in some of the things that tested on IQ, yeah, you can. Is there a big addiction potential with marijuana? No, there's not.
Okay, so you're firm on that. There is not a big addiction potential.
No.
There may
and
be
addiction's
a psychological...
I tend to use the word habituation, like the psychologists use. Can people become habituated to it? Sure. You can become habituated to anything. If you stop using suddenly, the withdrawal is usually rated as mild, and it's only 15% of people.
So what's the current status? I don't want to run out of time. We've only got
Go
a couple minutes left. Citizens in 20 states now and the District of Columbia have now voted to approve marijuana for medicinal applications, and it sounds like more states are considering this at this time. Obviously, you're in favor of this.
Very much so.
Tell me why, in just a quick, you know, quickly, why you think it's so important for us to make it legal and to change its status.
Well, Francis Young, who was a DEA judge in 1989, had a big review, five volumes worth, looking at marijuana and is it harmful? And what he said, and his conclusion was, it's the most therapeutically useful substance known to man. A little chauvinistic there, but that's how he phrased it. And there's no overdose deaths ever reported. Now, does it have, especially if you smoke it, does it have side effects? Yes, it does. But if you put it in comparison and in context to other things in a teenage brain, very often, especially with males, if they use marijuana, they use less alcohol.
And alcohol can be very damaging as well and very
addictive. Oh, much more so, especially while driving, because they still can't demonstrate any major driving effects of marijuana.
And obviously the problem with right now is that you can't really do much research because you really can't get a hold of the substance to
do it. The war on drugs has prevented that. The marijuana that was grown by the federal government in Mississippi was lousy marijuana, number one. Didn't even characterize it. So.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for coming in and expressing your very clear ideas about this. And I think things are starting to change, and it'll be very interesting to see over the next decade or so how things will change. My guest has been Dr. Gene Tinelli. He is an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Upstate Medical University. Thanks so much for coming in, Dr. Tinelli.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Upstate Registered Dietitian Terry Podolak with Healthy Eats. This week, I want to highlight the benefits of including apples in our menu planning. You've probably heard that old phrase, an apple a day keeps the doctor away, and I'm here to say there's some truth to that. We need a variety of fruits, but I'd like to honor the apple since it's a favorite of many in the fall. It is important to eat what's in season and what is local to our growing area because the less a fruit has to travel, the higher its nutritive value and fresher it tastes. The first benefit apples give us is fiber, both soluble and insoluble. The soluble fiber is called pectin. It helps remove cholesterol from our bodies and slows down the absorption of glucose during digestion. Pectin also promotes healthy bacteria in the colon. The soluble fiber acts as a prebiotic or food for the good bacteria. The insoluble fiber, or the skin, helps move things through our digestive tract to prevent constipation, hemorrhoids, and diverticular disease. I love to bake my apples in the oven with cinnamon, and for some of us, this also makes the skin a little easier to chew. Apples also provide us with a number of antioxidants. One is called quercetin, which is known to have anti-inflammatory effects, lowering levels of a general marker of inflammation called C-reactive protein. Our livers produce C-reactive protein, which can be measured through a blood test. High levels of the C-reactive protein are believed to be tied to heart disease. The fiber and antioxidants contained in apples may be why apples are thought to also lower cancer risk. Research is still underway to determine whether and how the risk is reduced for cancers of the lung, colon, rectum, breast, ovaries, and larynx. Apples have also been studied for their benefit to our brains in combating what's called oxidative stress and preventing the decline of chemical messengers known as neurotransmitters that occurs with aging. Apples have so many ways to improve our health. Our Central New York farmers grow a wide variety of apples, so I recommend whatever type you prefer, whether green or red, tart or sweet, soft or crisp. When possible, choose organic, but the most important is just to make sure to include apples in your menus, whether as a snack with peanut butter, baked or dried, on top of your hot cereal, or even on your salad. Most important, enjoy. This has been Terry Podolak reminding you to eat healthy.
Holiday time is especially challenging if you've lost a loved one. Next up, how to get through them while you're still grieving. And don't forget to stay with us for our visit from the Healing Muse. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
This is Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for December 2nd. Control the controllable. It is important to remember that the reason you're stressed might be out of your control. Don't let factors such as the weather or another person's actions cause you to worry. Instead, focus on the things you can control, such as reaction to the stressor. By sorting out what is manageable and what is not, you can work on the issues that are within your capacity and hopefully reduce your stress overall. Whenever you feel stressed this week, pause and think about whether or not the issue is within your control. Acknowledging that you're not at fault can help you relax and plan your next step. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. While the holidays can be very difficult for people who have experienced the death of a loved one, the memories of good times and togetherness at the holiday season can painfully remind us of our loss. So how can we cope with grief during these otherwise joyful times? Pat Moriarty is a grief counselor with Hospice of Central New York, and she's here with some answers. Welcome, Pat. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
So watching others who are feeling thankful or are celebrating when we feel potentially overwhelmed or lonely or sad can make it even more painful, I would think. Is this true?
Absolutely. I think when we feel so out of step with what's going on all around us, it can make our grief even more intense. That natural response to loss can really feel like it's overtaking us sometimes at holiday time.
Is this particularly true, would you say, during the first year of a loss, or do you think that it carries on?
You know, I do think that it's very difficult the first year, because you're kind of going on automatic pilot almost when you're trying to just get through the holiday, sometimes just doing what other people are suggesting that you do. What we found is that sometimes the second year can be the first time that you're actually going through the holiday on a more conscious level, where you're actually making your own choices. So yes, I think holiday and grief together are just a really difficult combination.
And things I've read before, people have often said that the holidays in general, although are meant to be joyful, even apart from a loss, many people's expectations of the holidays don't live up to their fantasy or their childhood imaginings. And so sadness often is a part of the holiday season, more than we'd like to admit in many cases.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
But specifically when it comes to the loss of a loved one, what would you say an important step or first step is in coping with that kind of grief?
I think, first of all, to acknowledge that you are in grief, to recognize that your life is now different, and although it is different, it doesn't mean it needs to be sad all the time. And so I think a first step is to actually sit yourself down and prepare yourself for the holiday. People can sometimes become immobilized out of a dread or a sense of overwhelm about the holiday coming at them. And if you can really take control of the holiday and realize that you have options about how it is you're going to deal.
Either by making specific plans or even obtaining support, because it would seem that that's an important piece of it.
Yes, to surround yourself by people who can be supportive is really important. And if you don't have that in your circle of family or friends, to really reach out. Hospice of Central New York has a hospice grief center that can be available and provide that kind of support to people.
That's good to know, and we'll have a link on our website for that.
Wonderful.
But tell me some other things. For example, when you talk about preparing, is part of it setting realistic expectations for yourself,
yes,
recognizing your grief, and then perhaps looking at the tasks and events that you would normally engage in and maybe deciding as to whether you want to continue them, whether you don't, who you might engage in helping, that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The holidays, as you say, are just so rich in traditions and culture and family rituals that we take part in. Families need to decide whether they're going to keep some of those traditions. Perhaps always having a big meal at Thanksgiving is something you want to keep. Or are they going to change those traditions in some way? Perhaps share the preparing of the meal or change things altogether. Perhaps instead of making the meal, you make reservations and go out to dinner on that day because it's simply too much. Your gas tank is only half full every day when you wake up, I think, when you are in grief. And to really be realistic about that lack of energy and the very real need to take care of yourself.
And it seems to me when you were talking about the whole notion of being around people who care about you, engaging them in those plans and
essential,
kind of wrestling through what makes most sense, and because memories can also be a source of comfort as well as pain.
Absolutely.
So it seems to me that those kinds of conversations really need to take place.
Yes. Once you have a plan set in your mind for how you wish the day would go, it is just so important to let family and friends know. People will very often want to be helpful but find themselves walking on eggshells trying to figure out what everyone would like. When if we could just be clear and let people know what it is we would like and what could make the day more manageable for us, then everyone can be happier.
Do you think people in desperation might consider canceling? You know, we're not going to have Thanksgiving dinner this year.
Yes.
Dad's gone.
Yes.
I mean, do you ever recommend that, or what do you recommend?
What we recommend is that people really look into their own heart and soul and really figure out what makes sense for them. Within a family, this can mean a lot of negotiating because what I need may not be what you need. And so we might need to come up with a plan that allows everybody to get a little bit of what they want. As an example, I worked with a man who had two young children, and he was widowed. And as many families do at holiday time, they did their own tradition with their own children in the morning and then went to see both sets of grandparents. This was just way more than David could do. He simply could not pull that off. And so he made the decision that he would do his own holiday with the children in the morning. He would bring them to his family's gathering for the big meal so that the children could be with their cousins, could be with family, the grandparents could see them, but he would not stay. He really left them in the care of his family. And then he picked them up and went to the other grandparents' home for the traditional dessert that they had together.
So he accommodated to what his needs were. Well, that goes back to the point I want to get to it in terms of how you deal with your feelings. But first, I just want to say, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, here along with Pat Moriarty. And we're talking about how to cope with your grief over the loss of a loved one during the holidays. So let's get back to feelings. Given that example that you just gave, this gentleman obviously knew what he could handle and what he could not.
Yes.
And I guess the question is, how should one... How do you counsel people to deal with your feelings? Obviously, you can't feel joy if you don't feel feelings. So
that's right.
You need to almost be open to all of them.
Yes, yes. In grief, the emotional impact of grief really runs the gamut from feeling numb, feeling sometimes quite sad, overwhelmed, lonely, anxious, vulnerable. Also, sometimes there's a sense of pride. I know I did a good job caring for my dad, caring for my mom. And sometimes there can be a sense of relief if someone has had a long illness with perhaps
protracted.
Some great pain. You would really want, wish for them that it be over, perhaps. And that can be hard to reconcile within yourself. So I think having... people, as you say, supportive people that you can speak that aloud with, that you can own up to those feelings yourself. And if you are someone who really never dealt well with anger or never dealt well with guilt and find it really overtaking you, to really reach out and ask for help. There are many different resources in our community that can be helpful to you.
I think what you're always saying also is you need to allow yourself to grieve and to also know that if you experience joy and laughter during these times, it doesn't mean that you've forgotten your loved one or that in some ways you're betraying their memory.
No, not at all.
That the full range of emotions should be welcomed or could be welcomed. And also one of the things that strikes me, and I know this from my own life, that people experience emotions differently.
Yes.
And every family member would have a unique way of experiencing it, and that there really is no really right or wrong way during that time.
That's absolutely right. Grief is very much an individual sort of thing that impacts us not only on an emotional level, but our physical self as well, our social self, and even our thoughts. People become forgetful and indecisive. There's intrusive thoughts and really a befuddlement that is often a part of grief. And people need to both lean into remembering their loved one well and also living well, kind of giving themselves time to be with the loss and feel the full range of feelings and to be able to replenish and restore and help themselves move into the next part of their lives.
Yeah, life goes on after
all.
It
does.
So how specifically do you often recommend to people you talk with for them to take good care of themselves? I mean, do you have some notion of specific recommendations, whether it be physical exercise, writing in a journal? Help us with that.
all of that. I think anything that allows you to get outside what is inside, so whether that is exercise or gardening or music or art or dance or talking or prayer or yoga, it really is as different as we all are. But to have ways that you can really explore everything that's inside of you about what it meant to have this person in your life and what it means now not to have them here in a physical way. Certainly, death ends a physical life, but not your relationship with the person. And so you can continue to kind of stand on their shoulders in many ways.
Keep them in your heart. Yes. Keep them in your memory. They live within you in a sense.
Hold you up, absolutely.
So do you have any suggestions since the holidays are so rich in tradition, for ways for people to perhaps either experience older traditions in a new way or start some new traditions?
Yes, absolutely. Certainly, some people find that simply waking up in the morning and remembering their loved one and saying, good morning, sweetie. I know you can't be with me today, but I want to tell you how grateful I am that we had this many years together. Some people find visiting a cemetery is helpful. For other people, there's absolutely no comfort in that. Some will have a special corner of a room with a candle and a photograph of their loved one. They may leave a photograph album open to kind of generate and prime the pump for conversation. They may well use the name of their loved one, create a memorial centerpiece that allows people to both be present to the holiday and bring their loved one into it.
So it's really kind of a creative opportunity to, in some way, continue to incorporate your loved one into the holidays.
Yes.
And do you think it gets easier? We have just a little bit of time. As time goes on.
I do think it gets easier, and I do believe that we are a resilient people. People have been able to survive and thrive in the face of grief, and you can too. There is such a thing as post-traumatic growth that allows us to become better versions of ourselves, to become more sensitive and compassionate.
That is just lovely. I want to thank you so much. My guest has been Pat Moriarty. She is a grief counselor with Hospice of Central New York. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing your wisdom with us.
Oh, thank you for sharing this with the community.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
This is Deirdre Neal, an editor of The Healing Muse. The holiday time can indeed be stressful, and it's good perhaps to take some time out and read something a little lighthearted. I've brought a selection from an essay in Muse 13. This is by a writer from Rochester, New York, Melissa F. Feederson. It's called Future Grandma, Green is Grief. It's a wonderfully lighthearted essay about the generations as a new baby comes into the family. Future Grandma, Green is Grief. If your mother seems neurotic around the baby, blurting out opinions that you must follow lest the baby suffer a terrible fate, perhaps ending up like, God forbid, the man you married, or if she seems to preempt your every move and every thought, try to look beyond the irritation and feel the love that pulses within her anxiety, like the little cardiac muscle that twitched within the gray clouds of your ultrasound. Take comfort in her. Take pity on her. Take that date night with your husband she insists upon. If you really want to scream every time she worries that the baby will be too cold, try planting a seed of worry that perhaps the baby is too hot. Remind her how overheated buildings are in the winter and how frigid they can be in the summer. Eventually, she will see that you can worry as skillfully as she can, that she has taught you well. This will make both of you proud. When your in-laws do the very things that surely doomed your husband to his terrible fate, such as making the baby laugh while he's eating or flipping the baby upside down after he's done eating, you might blurt out something that will make them scowl and say to each other, she's just like her mother. And though they don't mean it as such, you will regard it as a tremendous compliment. you just might start acting sweet to them. Acting sweet to your in-laws will surely irritate your mother.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore what makes for a safe sleeping environment for babies, plus the benefits of pre-kindergarten, and we'll get the latest on the crocodile and the other dangerous drugs on the street. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. And if you want to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.